which political heavyweights haven't paid their taxes, who could win big in Wisconsin, and why don't men and women strut down the same catwalks? I'm Andrew Tuck, and this is Midori House. As the Panama Papers topple the Icelandic Prime Minister, today we'll be looking at why tax is now the issue that global leaders from the UK to Argentina are having to fix for themselves. My guests, Kathleen Burke and Robert Fox, will be joining me to discuss this and the day's other top stories across the US, Australia and New Zealand on today's Midori House with me, Andrew Tuck. So welcome to Midori House, and my guests today are Kathleen Burke, Professor of Modern and Contemporary History at University College London, and Robert Fox, Defence Editor of London's Evening Standard. Welcome both to the programme. We're going to begin tonight in Iceland, where the Panama Papers, a huge cache of leaked documents from a Panamanian law firm, have now claimed their first high-profile political victim. The Icelandic Prime Minister has just stepped down. He'd come under intense scrutiny since the document's release on Sunday. The Prime Minister and his wife were named in the papers as being the owners of an offshore firm holding millions of dollars in Icelandic bank bonds. Kathleen, an extraordinary story. You get the feeling that we're going to see many more ructions in many more nations over the coming days and weeks. This huge cache of papers. But first, on the question of Iceland and the Prime Minister stepping down, do you think this is a lesson we'll see happening in other capitals?
Well, yes and no. I mean, no in the sense that it's peculiar to Iceland because these things were carried out during the 2008-09 Icelandic financial crisis, which you may remember nearly bankrupted the country. And so it's a particularly pointedly appalling coincidence, shall we say, of what happened. He was saving himself, the idea is, when everyone else was falling about him. It feeds in all over the world, I think, to the question of fairness, the question of equality. But will others come? Oh, yes. I'm sure we all have our little lists.
Robert, as Kathleen's saying, you know, we've charted the story of Iceland in Monocle over the years. And I guess that they were very good at PRing was here was a country that pulled together in the face of adversity. Even its political elite were kind of, you know, willing to roll up their sleeves and everyone kind of muck in. And the country has got back onto, you know, a good keel. But the feeling was, you know, everybody, you know, there has been a few bad bankers. Now we're all going to stick together. It turns out that many more people were not actually, you know, rolling up their sleeves after all.
Well, I think it's an everyday story of natural corruption, and it's not confined to one nationality. And that is one of the real stories of the Mossack Fonseca leaks. And actually, one of the things that nobody's really gone into, because I think it's the people who are publishing, protecting themselves, as to who leaked this. And I think it was probably an insider, it's looking like, who was just fed up with the whole thing. Look, the whole world, does globalization and global government mean global kleptocracy? I think that's what this person would worry about. And I think there is a healthy and an unhealthy side to the Icelandic story, as I see it from a distance, and being a devotee of the wonderful latest iteration of Scandinavian noir on television, which was Icelandic, interestingly, trapped. And it was a very faithful representation of not-so-small-town corruption. And by all the runes, to use a Nordic term, probably Iceland should have gone bust completely with the 2008. They were overextended. They'd borrowed profligately. And by very clever politics and arm twisting, they got their way out of it. Now, that's the bad side. The good side is I think that what we're seeing, and here I take a very European perspective, we're seeing politics getting closer to the ground. This is one of the real stories of 2016. The people are revolting. It's not just the peasants. It's absolutely the middle classes across Europe. They've been very interesting in Iceland. We're seeing protests of this kind all along the piece. And one of the great spokesmen as of this week with his book coming out is Yanis Varoufakis, the former foreign minister of Greece, because he is saying, to use an Italian term, basta, enough with this egregious inequality. And the activities of Mr. Gunnlaugsson and indeed of the David Cameron family, is that there's one law for the offshore rich and another law for the rest of us.
Well, and I just wanted to pick up on that, because we must point out that actually many of these people are not actually even accused of corruption. They're accused of, you know, kind of double standards, of doing things that were a conflict of interest, of keeping their affairs a bit too private by using offshore companies. And Kathy, Rob is making an important point here. There does seem to be some kind of shift that actually maybe 20 years ago, people would have turned a blind eye to that. You wouldn't have worried whether your prime minister was from a wealthy family and had some money stashed away in Switzerland. That would just be seen part and parcel of being part of the elite. But now, you know, many of these people are being fingered in this cash. You know, again, they haven't done anything particularly illegal. It's just seen as not morally right at this time.
Well, we have numbers now, of course, which we didn't have 20 years ago. So it's actually possible to envisage what the relationship is. I agree that in many cases, and probably in very many cases, it's not wrong. Avoidance is legal. Evasion is illegal. So therefore, it's not wrong if it's tax avoidance, which I presume is what the Cameron family were involved in. But I go back to my beginning comment. It's a question of fairness. It's a question, if we could all do it, that wouldn't be so bad. We just have better or worse lawyers. But since we can't all do it, since we don't have enough to justify our all doing it, because we are not equal, because fairness, because the question of equality in places like the United States is becoming more and more distant, this is, it's not precisely a scapegoat, but it is a center on which people can slash their anger in a way that is perfectly moral and very satisfying.
Well, he's been toppled, but Robert, when we look at many other countries, it's interesting, as you say, here in the UK, it's unlikely that the Prime Minister is going to be in too much trouble. It's his father that is accused of having an offshore account, an offshore company that money was put through. Interestingly, today, they've tried to quiz him on TV here in the UK, the British Prime Minister, and he has given one of those answers that leaves a chink in it, which you wonder why he didn't come completely clean. He said that his family at this time does not benefit from any kind of offshore companies. He doesn't own any shares. He owns his own home that he now rents out because he's in Downing Street. But he didn't actually say he won't ever, ever benefit from any money that is offshore. He didn't really come that clean, did he? So he's going to be, the heat is going to be on him here in the UK as well.
Well, I'm not intimate with the tax, banking and fiscal affairs of the Clan Cameron. But you're quite right to say there's a thought bubble which is hovering over the studio from out of my head now, called blind trusts. And, you know, how much has he got in blind trusts? What will he get out of it in the end? Prime Ministers, quite legitimately, as Kathleen was pointing out, Edward Heath, I think, for example, non-Prime Ministers like Dennis Healey had blind trusts, and they did very well indeed, because they were very, very well managed. And it is the Don Quixote Sancho Panza thing, the world divided into the haves and have-nots. But it is really big time now, particularly because of the roiling in the United States, the rage and seeking for redress that a lot of the supporters of Donald Trump seem to be looking for. And as I said, the division of rich and poor in the European Union, because Varoufakis is the most articulate of them, but even Matteo Renzi has raised this. Interesting, isn't it, that they're southerners. Was the European Union devised to have, they talk about a two-track or a two-tier system of the EU, but is the two-tier going to be the rich or richer and the poor and the poorer? And that is what is happening. And that's why pouring through this, all these debates about democratic deficit are absolutely surging through it. It is a very, very interesting time. You hear across the airwaves, in print at the moment, people quite seriously are discussing the values of democracy, the true values of democracy in not only 21st century, but in 2016.
Kathy, there is, again, an important point. Over the last few years, we've heard so much about, you know, young people not caring about politics, you know, that they're not going to vote anymore, they're indifferent to what politicians do, they have no opinions on things. There's been a real turnaround in the last couple of years. These kind of protest movements in, you know, across Southern Europe, across the US, people are very engaged But is it very joined up? Because, you know, Robert's right, you know, what Trump is tapping into is this kind of same populist vibe in a way, this anger, this feeling that politics can't carry on the same way. But in the end, do they care how much wealth Mr. Trump has? Obviously not, because they know that he's, you know, a billionaire and they're going to give him their votes anyway. So it's all a bit kind of, it's anger, but is it very well directed?
Well, remember that in America, people like people who make their way up. So the fact that Trump is a billionaire, recall in the old Puritan ethic, being rich showed that you had done properly and God was rewarding you.
Calvin.
That's right. So therefore, it's not such a bad thing. The idea in America is that everyone can do it. What's happening now is because it seems not everyone can because of the nature of what's happening in the economy. And also, it's of course, not Trump people so much as Bernie Sanders people. Has the young people who are trying to sort of change things for the future. So that's rather different. Young people at this point don't have so much to lose. When we were that age, you know, as I say here with my cane in my hand, it was easier to get a job. It was easier to save a bit of money. It was easier to make your way for all sorts of reasons. And in that case, nowadays, it's not. So therefore, if you don't have, we'll go back to Bob Dylan, shall we? You don't have nothing to lose. I think the whole approach to how you make your way in the world, people seem to have, there are barriers that didn't appear to be there in earlier days. And so I think people are going for a change. And this is particularly the case with younger people.
Robert, before we move on, just on this division line here, you know, I guess what's interesting is many of the papers that come out have really kind of begun to kind of show how very wealthy Russians have moved their money around, especially Russians encircling Putin. It seems unlikely any change will happen there whatsoever. Do you think that notion that, you know, we've often thought of Russia as a bit of a kleptocracy, that it is going to be revealed a little bit more?
Well, actually, you've touched on a point which I very much wanted to raise, which is the trouble is, yes, we can talk about the Cameron family quite, I think, in terms of the law, in terms of practice at the time, setting up an offshore a fund, a banking arrangement. But what has happened this time is that with this revelation is that people like the Prime Minister, now the former Prime Minister of Iceland, were in the same basket, as it were associated, and therefore there will be some taint attached to this without and out real gangsters, because we have Brinksmat robbers, the biggest robbery of bullion of all time in the UK. Certainly the Mediterranean and the Latin American mafias are involved in this, and they're treated by this company, by all accounts, in exactly the same way as people, kleptocrats from this side of the Urals or the other side of the Urals, want to park a few million rubles or dollars or billions.
I think
some
that
cases.
Is the thing: is the company that these people are keeping. Yeah. Even if what you've done is completely legal, and you know, maybe was even the right thing to do at the time, it now transpires that you were hanging out with kind of, you know, in your paperwork with kind of some of the dodgiest people out of Syria, out of Russia. Then suddenly it just does not look good for your standing.
Could I just say one thing we'll have to look at for the future is, it's not gone any further east than China. What's happened to all of Southeast Asia? Is it just that The Guardian and the other newspapers haven't quite made it past the first stack? Or is there something interesting here?
I think it's huge. I think it's absolutely huge. But I do think that you got a point. And I think it may well prove to be very, very regional indeed as to what happens. And it is the imagery. It's the semiotics, if I can put it like that, which I think is going to be so damaging to people like Cameron.
Well, we're going to move on now, and we're going to head to the US, which, interesting, hasn't been that caught up in this story, because in Wisconsin, later today, the Republicans and the Democrat primaries will see more of the nation making its voice heard to decide its presidential candidates. It remains the Trump-Cruz, Clinton-Sanders show. But to talk us through how it all looks from Wisconsin, let's hear from Katie Glick, national politics reporter for Politico, who's provided us a short, handy guide to how the state thinks.
Wisconsin typically votes for Democrats in the general election and has a strong union movement, but it is also home to a Republican governor, and the Republican Party controls the state legislature. The Democratic primary could get very interesting Tuesday night. Most polls show Bernie Sanders leading Hillary Clinton, but some show a tie. Madison, the state capital, is one of the most liberal cities in the country, so watch for Sanders to do well there. On the Republican side, Donald Trump is the frontrunner nationally, but here in Wisconsin, much of the party has united in their opposition to him. On a lighter note, another important thing to know about Wisconsin is that dairy is king here. It's a huge industry in the state, and the candidates here are often most likely to be found sampling cheese, especially cheese curds, as well as ice cream and other dairy products. To show support for the Green Bay Packers, which is the football team here and beloved in the state, Wisconsinites wear hats shaped like blocks of cheese, known as cheese heads. But so far, both Cruz and Trump have declined to support them themselves.
Cheese heads, you heard it here first. Kathy, the significance of tonight?
Well, it's very significant in certain ways. First of all, yes, the if Bernie Sanders takes this, and it's not a huge lead over Clinton right now. It's about 3.5 points. In fact, this is almost within standard deviation. So in that sense, it's going to be a tie. I mean, it's going to be really nice around 2 or 3 o'clock this morning. Obviously, for the Republicans, it is important. It's very important for Trump. If he doesn't take this one, it means that it's going to be a lot more difficult to get his 1237 for the nominating convention. But I think it's also interesting. Madison, Wisconsin is very liberal, but you have to look also up at the suburbs in the north. I mean, who is going to take those? If Trump takes those two, because they're more not suburbs, the rural areas in the north. If Trump takes those, he gets not only he gets a few delegates that he can use. Who's going to take the suburbs? There's a lot of suburbs coming up in the next several states. So I think the idea of just looking at Wisconsin as a big block is probably the wrong way to approach it.
Well, I love that the New York Times, they say that Wisconsin is tricky for Mr. Trump because people there tend to go to church frequently and be highly educated. So that's the New York Times take on why he's going to stumble. But do we think it is just a stumble, or has something more fundamental gone wrong with the Trump campaign over the last 10 days?
Well, I bow to Kathy's superior knowledge, experience, and insight on this. But in terms of projection, media, image, message, he's had a stinker of a week or 10 days, hasn't he? I mean, it's, you know, the abortion thing was absolutely hopeless and it was ridiculous, not the sort of thing that a grown-up person should be caught saying such things and then changing round. The manhandling of a reporter by one of his staff, that was not good. But you know, for the educated, as you've pointed out, his ramblings on foreign policy have been worse than embarrassing, as both the New York Times and Washington Post, who did address it seriously, they produced some very, very concerned editorials about it, and I must say, it worries me hugely. I mean, whatever we think about Obama, there is a highly intelligent man who he thinks very, very hard before he acts. But by golly, he thinks. And I must say, in my reading of the transcript of Trump, it was just the absence of real grown-up thought, which was so worrying.
Well, he says, though, you know, first he has to win the nomination, then he can be presidential, you see. So he thinks, you know, that you can fool most of the people all the time, as it were, is the idea. Mm. I mean, what's interesting is that, to me, well, many things about this are interesting, but first of all, is the fact that during the whole nomination process, he has been making these appalling quite surprising statements the whole way. Why now is it just all of a sudden this past week? I mean, Andrew's quite right. I think this past week, why is it now starting to make a difference? What is changing elsewhere? Is it that people, that there's a limit to what you can do? Abortion hits many, many elements of American life in a way that others don't. What is NATO? I mean, many Americans seem to think that NATO is there because the Americans it's all them doing and protecting Europe. No sense of that the United States needs NATO. The question of nuclear, the U.S. won't let them do it, so he can go ahead and say that. You see what I mean? That many of the things that Trump is saying either aren't believable, or people in many respects don't care, or they care a lot. And I think the caring a lot by some of them is what's starting to slightly break down his support. Even if you're a good old boy, the idea of making Japan nuclear is a bit of a showstopper.
Crazy.
I can hardly imagine.
And what's interesting, I guess, when you go into a state like Wisconsin, where suddenly the debate is kind of, you know, is going out national, and you see many more traditional conservative Republicans saying, you know, we just feel uncomfortable with this man, then that begins to change the national narrative as well. Because these people, you know, even the shock jocks of Wisconsin have come out opposed to him, saying this man is a rambling fool, he's not for us.
Well, you know, Republicans abroad, and they are, you know, they're cosmopolitan because they're abroad. The number of people that I come across from them in both in private and in public in debates like this, who say, well, actually, push comes to shove, we will really have to vote for Hillary. People like that are saying are so concerned about Trump. People who, as Catherine said, really do consider the problems of the renewal of NATO, possibly even the renewal of the UN, the nuclear question, which is absolutely roaring away, as to their credit, in a very serious, sober, and non-hysterical way, both Obama and Cameron underlined at the nuclear security conference. And a lot of my North American friends, Canadians as well, who are equally worried, said that we just cannot take a punt, cannot take a gamble. If you take half of what Trump says at face value, we can't take a gamble on this.
Trump's going to lose Wisconsin.
Just, yeah. Kathy, we're going to have to move on, but just quickly on the Bernie Sanders questions, he's already 230 delegates behind Clinton. He has no chance of catching up. But even a minor victory here, is it that he's just beginning to kind of dent her credibility too much, even if she does win?
Well, he can't. Well, maybe he is, but he has no chance in most of the rest of the states. So dented credibility is going to last for a week.
Okay, we are going to move on now. You're listening to Midori House here with me, Andrew Tuck, Kathleen Burke and Robert Fox. Coming up next, why are the former leaders of New Zealand and Australia after the same job?
Who are the young designers you should be looking out for? Who's leading the way when it comes to architecture, fashion, product and interior design? And what lessons from design history should we all be taking note of?
He really was an artist whose medium of expression was fashion.
I could never live in a place that I design because I'm not designing for myself.
You look for where there is a potential for creativity, for poetry. So architectural lighting, where the dialogue with architecture can become something very interesting.
Monocle 24's design program Section D delves deep into the places, communities, and manufacturers that make the design industry what it is. From trade shows to trend forecasts, tune in every Tuesday and make Section D the object of your attention.
Welcome back to Midori House here on Monocle 24. Still with me are Kathleen Burke and Robert Fox. Running the United Nations is no small task, but it doesn't hurt to get in a bit of practice by running a country first. Skills learned in that job might benefit former New Zealand Prime Minister Helen Clark, who announced her bid to be UN Secretary General today. But she might have to fight for the position against her former counterpart in Australia, Kevin Rudd. His intentioned campaign has not yet been confirmed, but there's every sign that he could soon could. Robert, who would you back out of these two? Would you think either would make a good leader of the UN?
I hope she'll forgive me using the racing metaphor. I think Helen Clark is ahead by a good neck, or possibly even a furlong, because she's a woman. She's got a very proven record. She's from New Zealand, and she hasn't got this maelstrom of party infighting that's going on. Even the ruling party, which was not Rudd's party, are fighting over whether they're even going to endorse him. Not that that particularly matters. He can still go forward, I think, as a candidate for this job. But I don't think it's going to be either of them.
Cathy, do you think Helen Clark would be a good Secretary General?
Well, yes. I mean, as Robert points out, she's female, and it seems to be that year.
Yeah, she did have a good reputation when she ran New Zealand. Yeah,
she was Prime Minister for 8 years, a very good reputation. I mean, even the opposition in New Zealand thinks it would be quite nice if she became. Problem with Kevin Rudd is no one supports him. Another problem, though, for
Helen... Monsieur Hollande does.
Well,
he supported every candidate, though.
That's what it said, yeah. He was backing them all. But another thing is it seems to be East Europe's chance, and there are three Eastern European females who are for it, the foreign ministers of Moldova and Croatia, and the Bulgarian Bakova, who's, in fact, headed UNESCO. So one could say that if you want someone who has sunk in the New York bureaucracy, she's your woman. So it's a problem saying Helen Clark is not the only woman. She may be from East New Zealand, but that's not good enough. She has to be from East Europe. So I think she's going to have, in this case, I mean, I think Robert and I agree, she would be a very good candidate. But I think it will be surprising if she actually gets it.
Is it a bit like Eurovision then? It's you get these groups of people voting in clusters. Will the Russian votes go to Moldova? Is it all kind of a bit pre-decided?
It's a bit like that, but it isn't. Because
no good songs.
At one stage, you would go for a weak UN Secretary General after they had a very strong one in Dag Hammarskjöld. It's quite a sobering lesson, this. And they went for weak ones after that, including one that they knew at the time was war criminal, Kurt Waldheim. But the United States at that time and the NATO allies, I'm not just a stooge for the Kremlin here, but they absolutely knew that. And they had the power to tip UN Secretary General out. They tipped out Boutros Ghali. They short-termed him. They got rid of him after the first term, which is most unusual. It is, what do you really want from this office? It is important. You cannot pluck people from the backwoods. I mean, Ban Ki-moon has done very well, but he came really from the deep recesses and wasn't really known, as happened with Pérez de Cuellar before him. But if you're going to go for a great civil servant, as they did with Kofi Annan, I would think that they would do as well. And I think there's still time to turn to a really good, tried and tested diplomat, albeit he's Italo-Scandinavian, is my first choice, and it would be somebody like Stefan de Mistura. Although I think he's slightly too old, Lakhdar Brahimi has got many, many of the qualities required. But this time, the Caucasus and cliques, it's Oceania, it's Eastern Europe. You're absolutely right. They'll knock each other out in the Caucasus for that. No, they want somebody who will run the organization, because the organization is one of the few international organizations of standing, left standing.
But, of course, Clark has also been head of the UN development.
And very, very good, I believe.
And kept, was tough administrator, apparently, and kept the budgets down. But remember, this time as well, it's an entirely new thing, because the CVs of all these people are up on the website. They're all going to have to be questioned by the Trusteeship Council. They're going to have public hustings, for heaven's sakes, in New York and London. So it's going to be very difficult for the permanent five to create a candidate in quite the same way as they're in the habit of doing.
Now, I've got a feeling that Cathy's been talking quite a lot because she didn't want to do the last subject. But the last subject is important. We have like 35 seconds to fit it in. And I think Robert Fox, a defence correspondent, is going to sashay down to give a quick answer. This is the news that Gucci are going to stage just one show for men's and women's wear, mixing everybody up, breaking up all the old seasonal differences. Robert?
Tears of nostalgia. Gucci starts in Florence in the 1960s, and I started learning Italian in Florence in the 1960s, and I still remember those links, those red and green bands. It's so last century. Poor old Gucci is doing this not to be progressive and modern, but it wants to have only one big show a year, and they usually have one for boys, one for girls, so they put it together.
Well, who can blame them?
It's Anglo-Saxon pragmatism that's come to the fore.
It will save some money, and it will certainly save some flights here at Monaco as well. But that's all we have time for on today's show. It was produced by Tom Hall, researched by Fernando Augusto Pacheco, Maria Granina, and Charlie Young. And our studio manager was Toby Hammond. There's more music next. Then at 1900 hours, it's Section D with Josh Fennett and Henry Rhys Sheridan. We'll have more of the day's stories on the Monocle Daily. From me, Andrew Tuck, goodbye.